Mayor Howard Lee, Chapel Hill, December 13th, 1973.
Ability of, I think, blacks to make inroads into the political arena, to wield a certain amount of power and influence, has not been tapped to 50% of its potential. And I base that not on the number of electorates of people who've been elected to office, because I think that is an obvious overt center, a symbol of progress within itself. And that's only one part of it. So I'll start with the second part and then come back to that part. The other part is that I'm thinking of the registration, of the educational aspect of it, and the participatory aspect of it, that blacks still do not participate in politics as I think blacks should. We're not registered to the levels that the potential is there. If we just took North Carolina alone, where there are about 310,000 blacks registered out of a potential of 750-some thousand, we can see the disparity. If we look at the participation in the any political or given election, even when Reginald Hawkins was running for governor in 1968, we'll find that the voter activity was fairly low. When we look at precinct participation and my own congressional race in 1972, we'll find that basically I lost that election because a large number of blacks didn't go to the polls. But on the other hand, the black who's been elected to office, in fact, I think, brings a new attitude into office, because we have, and we've made some changes. We've grown some, too, over the last few years. We've seen the movement from the northern politics, where most of the blacks who have been elected, with only a few exceptions, have been elected by a large black populace, including the recent election in Detroit, which was done completely along racial lines, to the southern political arena, where it was not a racial line voting so much. It was a cross voting type. And it seems to me that the black who is in politics is in there to try to bring a sense of fair play, a sense of equality. And in so doing, I think there is the possibility that much more courage and a better sense of boldness is transferred to the white politician, who will also stand up for a greater sense of fairness. Not that there haven't been those who've done that in the past, but I think many more are willing to do it in the future. Another quick example is in running in the 2nd District Congressional race, we could not get a white politician to take on Congressman L.H. Fountain. The attitude was that Congressman Fountain couldn't be beaten. But after I took him on and made such a good showing, now there are several people out there who are willing and ready to take him on. As a matter of fact, it's 44.7%. So there are some good people now who are willing to take him on, and who, I think, stand a fairly decent chance of winning. So that's one instance, I think, where myself, being a black, ran in an election and has caused the attitude of whites to change toward running in a congressional race.
Can we back up a bit? You mentioned Detroit, the fact that was strictly a racial vote. Yeah. Yet in Raleigh and Chapel Hill, I assume Atlanta,
right,
you don't have that, or you didn't have it. Well, if you think 10 years ahead, do you think that's going to be the trend in the North as compared with the South, or was this something that just happened in the last couple of years here as really an accident?
Yeah. As I see it, and I hope I'm wrong, but as I see it, I believe that this is going to be the trend in the North for a long time to come. And I say that for the simple reason that the interaction among the races in the North is quite different from the interaction among the races in the South. One of my favorite sayings is that in the South, We have rejected each other as races, but accepted each other as individuals. In the North, they have accepted each other as individuals and rejected each other as races. So I feel that mainly because of this large disparity, this wide disparity between the attitudes of people and between people themselves, this will continue to be. I think it will become the Atlantas, the Raleighs, and the Chapel Hills, and a few other cities, with a few exceptions thrown in, the Richmonds and the Charlottes, of course, will certainly become more of the rule than of the exception in the South.
So you see a coalition politics developing in the South, but not in the North.
Exactly.
It's almost the reverse of Key's hypothesis. In order to understand the politics of Detroit, you have to understand the politics of race.
Yeah. And now, why that is, I'm not sure I'm in a position to say, except what I've already said.
Los Angeles would be some exception to that rule. Of course, that's not necessary. The West.
Yeah, that's the West. And I'm not sure that there is any way to compare the West to any other section of the country. Los Angeles politics is quite different from any other politics I know. California politics is quite different from any other politics I know. I think coalition politics certainly is possible in the most part of California and will continue to be.
What sort of coalition do you think is going to work best in the South?
I see a trend of working class black, working class white, poor black, poor black, poor black, poor white coalitions coming together around common issues affecting these groups. And influencing very definitely the direction of politics here. I think there's always been a kind of an upper-class coalition in the South, that is, among the upper-class blacks and among the upper-class whites. There's been a sense of communications, a sense of loyalty that has existed between these two. I think it has been these two groups of people that have basically, over the years, kept the lower groups of people separated as much. And I believe that this will change greatly, and this will be the kind of coalition that will hold the greatest hope for us in the future.
Now in Raleigh, the indication that I have without a careful study of the precincts is that it was more of a black coalition with suburban whites, because of the issue there was primarily one of growth regulation and zoning.
Mm-hmm. I think certainly issues will influence, and there's not enough going on right now to influence a trend. But I think in so many cases across the South, as I've looked at it, I look at my own congressional race, I looked at Andy Young's congressional race, and I've looked at other types of races that have gone on, and this seems to have been the coalition that has migrated together, even in Smithfield, North Carolina recently, where the big Klan sign continues to stand. The coalition that tended to try to form was a working-class black, working-class white coalition. In Sanford, it was the same indication, particularly as we had difficulty getting the professional black, per se, to participate in the political arena and to come out and vote on that particular day.
How did you get into politics?
Backwards. I've always been interested in politics. I suppose I first started actively when Reginald Hawkins ran for governor in 1968. Dr. King had been assassinated, and I had rejected Reginald Hawkins' campaign as being a fluke joke campaign. After the assassination of Dr. King, I needed a way to protest, and to head up Reginald Hawkins' campaign seemed to me to have been the healthiest way that I could protest. And I did. And of course, in so doing, we were able to deliver Chapel Hill for Hawkins. And this was a coalition between what we called then the McCarthy forces and the Hawkins forces. After that campaign, in late 1968, I got the idea that because Chapel Hill had never had anything except a so-called conservative businessman mayor, that Chapel Hill ought to have a liberal white mayor. So I went to a friend of mine and suggested that he run and I'd be his campaign manager. He in turn went to the newspaper and indicated that he had heard I was going to run for mayor. The newspaper printed the story. And it was from that point that I was drafted. So that's why.
Newspaper done it to you again.
So how did that campaign go?
Well, for me, it was initially something that I wasn't sure I should do, in spite of the newspaper story. Naturally, Chapel Hill was split. A lot of people who voted for Reginald Hawkins voted for him knowing full well that he couldn't win, and they wanted to protest against the Democratic machinery. Found it very difficult to accept my candidacy. To make a long story short, I basically decided that I should run after we had a meeting here and someone told me the time wasn't right. And I'd heard that as much as I could take it. And it was because of that, mainly, that I declared my candidacy. Without any thought to any organization, without any thought to any real issues, without anything that one usually ought to think about before declaring a candidacy. Then the only reality or the rationale upon which I could base my campaign was that I was really running to raise issues that my opponent would have to deal with after he was elected mayor. And we started out with 12 people, raised $5,000 for the campaign. I had the news media against me, and of course, no experience in public office. My opponent had served 12 years on the Board of Aldermen. I'd only been in Chapel Hill 4.5 years. My opponent had lived here all of his life. I was working at Duke University. My opponent worked at the University of North Carolina. All of these things just spelled defeat. As it neared election day, of course, it was determined that the election was too close to call. And to my surprise, even though I had geared myself up psychologically to lose, the night of the election I won. And for me, that was the beginning of a kind of a...
How did you feel that night when you saw those returns come in?
Scared as hell. I turned to my wife. My wife says I turned to her and said, I don't recall. Now that I've got it, what the hell am I going to do with it? I felt frightened, greatly uncertain about how to take the reins of the mayoralship. I felt as if I had been put on a tightrope because it was not fashionable at that time among blacks to be in the system, so to speak. Blacks were immediately saying that in order for me to win in Chapel Hill, I had to be an Uncle Tom or sellout. There was a certain amount of apprehension on the part of the white community as to whether or not a black could really come in here and do the kind of job as mayor that it should be done. But I felt very lonely, very isolated. I was concerned about my family, too, because immediately the threatening telephone calls started. The night we got home after the election, my wife received a telephone call and was told she should get the casket picked out because I had 2 days. And so for us, the first 6 months were quite hectic.
Quite an uncertain time. How do you feel about those kind of calls? Were you anticipated?
Yes, they were anticipated. We had gone through this before many, many times, and so I did not become paralyzed over these kinds of calls. We'd gone through it when I'd worked in the civil rights movement down in Georgia. We'd gone through it when I decided to buy a house in Chapel Hill in 1966 and decided that I would not buy in the black community, but I would instead buy in the white community. We had received threatening telephone calls. And so by this time, we were relatively used to the idea, as used to it as one becomes. I suppose one takes any such threatening calls seriously, but does not allow these calls to paralyze him. My greatest concern was my wife and my family and how they would take it. And we often shored each other up through constant conversation. justifying and rationalizing on why I had to do this at this particular time, presenting it to the children as our price that we would have to pay, not just for the writing of the history at this time, but also for opening the doors for them and for their grandchildren tomorrow. It was very difficult for our children initially, to the extent that our daughter and son, we had two children at that time, who were making A's and B's in school. Their grades fell off to D's and C's. We ultimately had to pull them out of public school and put them in private school for 2 years. Our daughter never did return to public school. Our son is currently in public school. But it leaves one cold, leaves one frightened, but it also, I think, made me more determined to come into this office and be a success. To be a success for the simple reason that I felt I'd been given a tremendous public and social responsibility. And if I failed, that I closed the door in the faces of hundreds of minorities and blacks for years to come. But if I succeeded, I made it possible, not just in Chapel Hill, for other minorities and blacks to have an opportunity, but in North Carolina and possibly throughout the South.
How do you feel about it now? Did you succeed?
I feel that I've succeeded. And I feel that I succeeded not alone by any stretch of the imagination. I feel that I succeeded, number one, because there was a certain inner strength that made me weather that tightrope that I was constantly on. But I feel that I succeeded because there were a lot of people, both black and white, who were willing to stand with me in those difficult periods. I think one can look at my administration and where we came from, the fact that Chapel Hill had a pure ceremonial mayor when I was elected, that the mayor did not have an office when I was elected. The mayor had no budget, no staff, and all he ever did was to hold meetings, presidable meetings, twice per month, and vote in case of a tie. To have brought in the kinds of programs we have, to have gotten the kind of support we've gotten, and to have been elected in 1969 by 52% of the vote, re-elected in 71 by 63%, and then in 73 by 92%, I feel is an indication of progress and of truly being able to bring the community together.
Looking back now, do you think that you would have believed in 1969 you'd be right now where you are in terms of the pluralities you've received, what you think you've done?
No. I felt that I had only one term to serve in this office, and that's about all I gave myself. I really did not think, as I looked ahead from 1969, that I would succeed in getting people to accept me. Because I felt, as I looked ahead, that there were too many odds stacked against me. That there was the black population with its many diversities, the militant element, the radical element, the docile element, the jealous element. There was the white community with this racist element, the conservative element, its radical element. And of course, all of those things didn't seem possible. I looked at the form of government Chapel Hill had here, the fact that it had a city manager form of government, and the mayor was in fact at the mercy of the Board of Aldermen. And the makeup of the Board of Aldermen at that time was a very independent group of people. I felt that the best I could do again would be to propose programs and try to justify them on why Chapel Hill needed them, and to go after them as hard and as aggressively as I could. And that's exactly what I did. On the basis that I would not be reelected in 1971, I made some mistakes in the beginning, which further made me feel I wouldn't be reelected. The first one I made was to have made a speech in Washington in September of 1969, after I'd been denied an appointment to the faculty with the School of Social Work here as an associate professor at the University of North Carolina, and learned later that the then Governor Scott had had a direct hand in the denial of that. I became very emotional in Washington at a black elected officials conference and called the governor a Southern Democratic bigot. That made the news throughout North Carolina probably before I finished saying it, and caused me real difficulty back here in North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Even some of my stronger supporters were ready to turn their back on me at that time. So by the time I got back home, I was almost convinced beyond the shadow of a doubt that in addition to all these other problems, and that particular colossal mistake had sealed my defeat for 1971. But at the end of that first year, I felt that I was making some progress. I had a mayor's office. The Board of Aldermen was supporting most of my programs. I had a staff assistant. I had begun to be invited to speak to some of the local civic clubs in the community. And people were beginning to talk to me. Businessmen were beginning to talk. They were beginning to listen. They were beginning to call me mayor, whereas before they called me nothing. And from that, I felt maybe I do have a chance. And then there were a couple of problems in the community. And this was the year of problems. There was a worker strike on the University of North Carolina campus. The strike had gone on for about 2 weeks, and our policemen had been used in that strike by basically the establishment to prolong the strike. And one night there was a clash on the campus between our policemen and the strikers, and I made the decision to pull the police off. 2 days later, the strike ended. That I got praise for. Then there was the student marches and demonstrations against the Vietnam War, and I made it possible for the students to march and to demonstrate, and without any difficulties, to the extent that when they had sit down in the middle of the street, I would sit down with them, and they would become embarrassed and leave. We did it without police interference. Then there was a young black boy that was killed by a white motorcycle gang on the campus of the University of North Carolina, and I was able to quell a potential race riot evolving from that. These three things, I think, did more to push me then high in the political polls in North Carolina, in Chapel Hill. Plus, Governor Scott appointed me, after we mend our fences, as the first black to hold an officership in the Democratic Party as vice chairman, one of the vice chairmen of the party. That was another boost. And all those things together by the end of the first term had put me in a relatively strong position. I really had come to believe that by 1971 I would not have any opposition, but that was a little much to hope for. And I did in fact have opposition.
How did you mend those fences?
Well, first of all, I publicly apologized. I sent the governor a telegram indicating to him that I shouldn't have done what I did in the way in which I did it publicly, that I should have come and talked with him about our differences. Secondly, I paid a personal visit to the governor and talked with him, and we had a meeting of the minds. And thirdly, I had some friends to intervene on my behalf with the governor. So those three things brought the two of us back together. And the first chance I got to support one of the governor's programs, I did that. In return, I got his full support for a number of my programs.
What were, the major programs? You said you became programmed, decided you'd have to make proposals and implement them, and that you did. What were the major, just two or three that stand in your mind that were significant?
The public transportation system was one that I had run on, and I felt that I had an obligation to get public buses on the street in Chapel Hill, and to get them on the street with a subsidy. I still hope those buses will be on the street by August of 1974. The other was to wrestle the utilities from the University of North Carolina control. This resulted, of course, in my first appointing a utilities committee, and then, of course, the governor appointing a state utilities commission, which ultimately advised the university to divest itself of its utilities, to increase the amount of public housing in Chapel Hill. And I was successful by making friends with the Undersecretary of the Housing and Urban Development, who at that time was Samuel Jackson. Sam and I became good friends, and of course, through Sam was able to bring in about 150 units additional public housing to add to the 60 here. Those are three. To increase the salaries of the employees in the town, to carry employees from their $4,100 starting salary, policemen and firemen from 43 and garbage collectors from 33, to 6,000 for policemen, 5,700 for garbage collectors, for firemen, and 4,700 for garbage collectors, and to establish a $2 minimum wage. Those were some of the major things that I pushed on and were successful in getting through.
In the context of the civil rights movement, say going back to 1948, do you see any discrete periods or progress within that where there was a lot more progress than, say, the 5 or 10 years before that? Did you see it as a steady kind of a thing, or were there spurts of great progress?
From 1948?
1948.
I think the big spurt came in the... I think there are periods. I think there was from 1948, and 1948 is the time when I first became quite cognizant of what was going on, because it was about 1948 that I decided that I would never leave the South. It was in 1948 that I saw my father humiliated in Lithonia, Georgia, my hometown, because of me. Lithonia, Lithonia. Excuse me. Because of me, he had been very humiliated in terms of having to pay off a grocery bill he owed, which took all of his paycheck for 1 week. And I became very angry. And this was on a Friday, the following Saturday, I went into town and decided I wanted to protest, and decided that I was tired of seeing colored and white on bathrooms. So I went into the white male's bathroom and used it. Came out, and that didn't seem to satisfy me, so I went into the white female's bathroom and used it. Came out, and then I found myself face to face with about four big bullies, all of whom beat me pretty badly. It was then that I first became really aware of what the South was like and why I should not follow through with my plans up to that point, and that was to go to New York as soon as I finished high school. And I decided to stay in the South. I didn't feel like very much progress was being made at that point. I graduated from high school in 53. It was in 54, I think, the first big spurt came with the school desegregation case. And I don't think much happened from then in other areas of the society, with the exception of in the public schools. I think that was rather gradually going along, but nothing else was happening. Then in the early 1960s, I feel that when the college students really got involved, that was the next big spurt. And it focused on the public accommodations. And then I felt, again, nothing was really happening to offer or solidify a power base until 1965, when the real progress started to be made in voter registration. So those are the three most significant periods, 1954, 1960, and 1965, that stand out in my mind.
What was the incident that said you caused your father to have his humiliating experience?
I was chewing bubble gum, and the store owner was trying to figure out the bill. As I look back on it now, I was probably being very annoying in popping my bubble gum. And he looked at my father and said, "Get that nigger out of here." And my father said, "That's my son, that's not a nigger." And he said to my father, "Are you getting smart with me, boy?" And my father says, I'm not a boy. This is my son. I'm a man. And he says, okay, man, you pay off your damn bill. And kept his check and ran him out of his store.
How significant did the Voting Rights Act?
I think the Voting Rights Act, as an action, was extremely significant. And I think it gave us a significant tool that certainly was used. I think voter registration was increased. I think the Voting Rights Act, however, was looked upon by so many people as being an end to all ills, that it was passed and our problems were over. And all of us fell into that very basic trap of feeling that everybody's going to register and everybody's going to vote. I think the act itself has been the real difference between the progress we're making now politically as opposed to the progress I think we have made in all other areas of society, even in public accommodations, in everything, in housing. I think that this is the one thing that not only has changed things at this point, but will be the one key in changing things as we look ahead to the future, to ensuring that the South becomes the South that we've often talked about, that we've often dreamed about, that all of us at one time or another have spoken about. But I think what we need to do now is to recognize that the Voting Rights Act only becomes a key, and that it becomes the responsibility of those of us who are in office to ensure that the door is open and that people are encouraged to walk through the door. But to me, at this point, the Voting Rights Act is at the very basis of any future success we have in equality and justice in this country.
Voting Rights Act is scheduled to expire in 1975. How important is it that it be renewed?
Well, I think it's very good to always keep a law on the books if it's a good law. And I think this one is a good one. I would like to see the act renewed. I do not think we're over the hill yet. There's still too many sections of our country that are only making it possible for people to participate because they know the act itself exists. I think it's extremely essential that the act be renewed for another period. But I think it's more important that this time we get the message across that we have to use what is made possible under that act.
Some of the blacks we talked to tended to view the 50s as kind of a constitutional or legal phase in the movement, and the 60s as kind of a protest, maybe even a violent phase. And the 70s as perhaps a consolidation, or once the doors have been opened, that every opportunity be exploited at that point, and more emphasis be placed on education and economic opportunities. How do you feel about that view of the so-called movement?
I think the 50s were pretty much legal. I think the 60s surely were protests. But I think as we neared the end of the 60s, we began to do what I think we're doing a lot more of right now in the 70s, and that is to become to understand strategy and how to use that strategy. And I see the 70s as being more of a strategy decade.
That's what I should have said. Yeah. I was groping for the word. Strategy is the word that we do.
And the 1980s, then, will be the real period of implementation of what we've been able to develop through our thinking, our interaction, and having some success, testing out certain strategical type tools, certain plans, and putting them into action. I think whereas in the 50s and the 60s we had the one leader concept that we all had to rally around, the 70s have taught us that there is no such thing as a one leader. As Ozzie Davis has put it, that we have understood clearly now it is not the man, it is the plan. And it seems to me that the plan is really being formulated in the 1970s. And that we are also getting across a different message, that civil rights in the 1970s is not just civil rights for blacks. It is civil rights for people. And we hopefully are getting across that whites and blacks benefit equally from the progress that is made in civil rights. I think this will be the only real hope for talking seriously about successful implementation in the 1980s. And I think if we keep focusing on blacks in the 1970s, that, you know, this is only for blacks, that by 1980 we will not have made that much progress. I think the emphasis is truly shifted from the public type social goals to what you indicated, education, politics, and economics.
We interviewed John Lewis the Tuesday after George Wallace had crowned the Queen of the University of Mississippi. And had also appeared before the conference of black mayors.
Were you at the conference?
Yes.
Could you have foreseen this 3 years ago or 2 years ago, indeed, 60 days ago? We just have to think that was sort of a significant event this year.
Yeah. I think that it's more significant than many people are willing to even accept it as being, mainly because so many people are hung up on what George Wallace used to be, they refuse to accept the kind of influence of what the man might possibly be. No, I could not have foreseen that 60 days ago. If someone had asked me 90 days ago if George Wallace would crown a black as Miss Alabama, I would have said no, I would have taken a bet on it. I think to me that is so significant. It is significant, and it's a lesson that many of us ought to learn, in that here is the same man who stood in the door of the same school from which he had to be removed by the National Guard, by a president who is no longer with us, unfortunately, and goes back almost in front of the same door and crowns a female, and it was the female that he was keeping out of that school, as Miss Alabama. And then, because he had been invited to come and welcome the black mayors to North Carolina, on Friday evening, could not make it, sent word on Saturday that he would love very much to address the black mayors on Sunday, and then came and made what I consider to be as healthy of a speech as I've heard by anyone. It's not the kind of speech I would have expected to have heard from George Wallace. I think that this says something. I'm not sure I know what it says. People tried to rationalize it at the conference from the fact that George Wallace was running for re-election and he would do anything to get re-elected governor of Alabama, to the bullet that is still in George Wallace has really affected his brain to the extent that he's not thinking rationally these days, and he'll do anything because he's not thinking rationally. But yet, I think George Wallace stands somewhat as a symbol of a person who is capable and able to make certain kinds of changes, to be somewhat flexible. Maybe the assassination attempt did have something to do with it. But I've seen too many George Wallaces in the South who have changed. I've seen people who are not in the limelight. I've seen the man who gave me my first job when I was a junior in high school and paid me $9 a week and made me buy a bicycle to deliver his groceries and took $5 a week out for the bicycle. Asked me to come and have dinner with he and his wife the last time I was home at his table, and he never let a black walk in his front door before then. I saw a farmer, peanut farmer, down in the 2nd District in North Carolina when I was campaigning for Congress, asked me to come have dinner with he and his wife, his children, and his mother-in-law out at his farm. I think that George Wallace, to many degrees, is representing the changing South. And I think if there's a symbol of where the South has come, it all kind of came together in one ball in Alabama on that Saturday, on that weekend, rather.
I understand from some of my newspaper friends that one of them subsequently asked George Wallace why he didn't kiss the homecoming. he said he didn't think that either she or the state of Alabama was ready for that.
I doubt that either one of them would have been ready for that.
One of the persons we interviewed, we asked him about the state of the Democratic Party in North Carolina, said it was like a bird with no head and no body. It was just all wings. It was the Black Wing and the Sanford Wing and the Taylor Wing and the Scott Wing and the Eastern Wing and the Western Wing ad nauseum.
So all the wings are flapping.
And all the wings were flapping. Can you give us some insight as to what you think of the condition of the party is and where it might be going in 74 and 76, statewide office as well as congressional?
That's the best description I've heard of it. I hadn't heard that one, but it's pretty good. I don't really know. I think probably the thing that concerns me most about the party is that it's being controlled by too small a group of people right now, whatever there is left of the party. I don't really think we have a party in North Carolina right now. I think we have a name, and we have a few people in a few positions, and that's about where it is. I feel that that's our challenge, and I was involved in some meetings today about that very subject of how are we going to deal with the Democratic Party. The fact that George Wallace has been invited to North Carolina and it's being billed as a unity rally is in fact causing some real difficulties for a lot of people, and I'm very much in the middle of trying to see what can be done to iron that out. The fact that a prominent black has never been invited to speak to any affair in the state of North Carolina under the auspices of the Democratic Party is causing some real difficulties, and we're going to have to work that out. The fact that we do not have a real leader of this party right now, and that most of our leaders are running for something, and really are more interested in putting together their own teams than they are trying to see what can be done to build the party, I think is a true indication of how weak it is. In 1974, I think that there's a good chance that we could probably see the Democratic Party, first of all, changing leaders in the middle of the stream. That is, the head, the titular head, as well as the chairman of the Democratic Party being changed. As a matter of fact, I think that might be one thing that might have to happen in order to get us back on the track. As far as 1976 is concerned, I wish I could tell you.
Would that, in 74, would that be against their will? Would the executive committee have to, how do you remove a titular head?
I think it's going to be done in the convention. And I don't know how you do it. I see one of two things developing, and the reason I say that is that, number one, there are still a group of people who are very loyal to the Democratic Party, but there's also something developed out here called the North State Caucus. On the other hand, there is an organization developed called the Democratic Coalition, and then there's another group coming together calling themselves Progressive Democrats of North Carolina. All of these are developing around the so-called Democratic Party. I feel that there's a good chance the Democratic Coalition and the Progressive Democrats of North Carolina will come together and try and take over the party in 1974 at the convention. I don't think anything is going to happen at the Executive Committee meeting in January of 1974. In 1976, anybody who's a potential leader now, such as Jim Hunt, Skipper Bowles, or any of the rest, are going to be running for office. And how that shapes up, I wish I could tell you.
You go along with the hypothesis that 1972 was an aberration, it was an accident. That's what elected Holzhauser and Helms. That things are going to get back to, quote, normal, end quote, in 74 and 76.
No, I don't. I don't think it was an accident. I think it was a happening, something that had to come because the party itself had, number one, veered too far away from what the party was supposed to be in, and that is an organization that had constantly been concerned about the common man and addressing the issues and problems and concerns of that person. And I think the Democratic Party in 1972 tried to out-Republican the Republicans. And I really think that unless the Democratic Party is prepared now to begin to take some stands on issues, to stop trying to tiptoe through the tulips, and to stop trying to be so uninvolved that it doesn't make any waves, that in 1976 there's a good chance that the Democratic Party will get defeated again. I feel that over the next 2 years it is going to be imperative that we come forth with a very solid program addressing some of the very basic issues that are most concerning, that are concerning people most. Now, we can do it as a party, or we can do it as fragments of the party, or some of us can do it as individuals. I personally would like to see it done through the party structure. I'd like to see the party talk about taxes and make some proposals to deal with the energy crisis and make some proposals to talk about the need for health care delivery and make some proposals, and then work on the General Assembly, the legislature, the legislative body, because we do have the Democratic majority there. Get those Democrats to act aggressively and progressively on behalf of the common people, and take credit for it if necessary. But I don't have any hope that that's going to happen. I think what will happen is that we'll all go on acting as individuals. I'll go on making my speeches and talking about certain kinds of things that I think are important, and others will go on doing the same thing.
Well, if enough people in the party believe it was just an accident and we're going to get back to normal, why should they take the route of discussing issues and positions?
If enough believe that, they shouldn't and they won't. I really think that those people who believe that are the ones who are in the power and the seat of decision.